It's going, yeah.
Thunderstruck, AC/DC, and not going to say Geronimo. My very, very welcome guest in the studio is old friend Alan Sicard, who is a retired police superintendent. What are you on? What number there, Alan? Number four. Well, say hello to your adoring fans. Is that one coming? Yeah. Alan is very welcome in the studio. He was last here in March this year, and we were starting off with sort of a rough, launching your book or something?
Yeah, it was at that time the book wasn't due to be launched until the end of June, so it was kind of just a preemptive discussion.
Just a rehearsal.
Yes, yeah. That was very kind of you to have me on to just highlight that the book was coming, yeah.
Right, yeah, okay. Now, it's been 3 months since the book was...
Yes, yeah.
...was coming. How's it been going?
Been...
Is there somewhere that you could check every night and say, oh, look, I've sold that
book? You know, well, I self-published the book, so I didn't go through a publishing house, so I did it myself. So, yes, I know I'll get an email when someone's bought it from my website.
Oh, do you?
Yeah,
oh, okay.
Yes, yeah, because I've got it's quite a beautiful thing to do because you get an email that someone has bought your book, and then my next... pleasure really is I go and wrap it, like I sent you a book. I have a particular personal bookmark made up for the book, The Courage to Lead.
Lovely. Yeah.
And then I have a kind of a card in the book as well that has a little leadership saying that's not in the book anywhere. That's something that I've created as a quote.
We're looking at it now, dear. Yeah.
So and then that's,
whose idea was that?
Is that mine. That was mine. Yeah. Yeah. And then I get to wrap it all up in some white tissue paper, I suppose you call it.
Yeah.
And then I send it to whoever wanted it. So it's it, and then I actually write a little quote in the front of the book. So it's just a privilege to do.
Well, it's a privilege to me because, as you said, no, I'm not going to read that out. It's personal to dear Jeff. I've got all these notes, all these things that I was going to ask you about. You ready for some penetrating, probing questions?
Yes, go for it. Yeah, thank you, Jeff, probably, and thank you to all your listeners for the privilege of being back here, because it's something quite dear to my heart.
Yeah.
The effort, the learning experience of writing a book is something that I never thought I'd do.
Probably people have told you this, Don, when I've read some of the reviews. It is a delightful book to read. I mean, you sort of pick it up and you don't put it down because it's spoken, you in the first person,
yes,
throughout the whole book. And you put it down and you think, oh, I wonder what those look like. And then you get to the end to all the photos.
Yes.
Well done, yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. It's not an elephant in the room, but the first thing that you come out with is the email, the email that you received. Do you know where that came from or not?
I know the origin.
I'll just give you a little bit of a bit of a flavour, dear listener. The email that Alan Sicard received was, you mention your first command, we cast you out of there like the incompetent man that you are. When I read this, I thought, ooh. You gave us no support and lacked spine. Watching you leave was the most satisfying thing. You found us and we won. Glad to hear you're gone from the job. Gives me the confidence to rejoin. Well, there's a clue, I suppose. But you think you knew who it was, or did you?
Oh, I have an idea, but it just highlights...
You can't please everybody.
Yes, and the book is about essentially failing forward. So the book's written for anyone that wants to have a go at some type of leadership position, whatever it might be. It might even be just a leader of a family or leader of a sports team, or whatever,
right.
And the book is about you can't please everyone, but at the same time, that period of my life, the chapter's called The Good, the Bad, and the Ugliness of Failure.
Yeah.
Sometimes you're in a position where you are out of your depth and you're going to make mistakes. You have to admit that your role in those mistakes.
And know when to seek help.
Yeah, and just learn from it, get mentors.
Right.
Learn from other leaders and just get better at leading. So, like, in that email that you just read out,
yeah,
probably when I retired, I would have got nearly 400 wonderful emails, and there was only two bad ones. Really? The other one was so nasty about my family that I didn't put it in.
Oh, my goodness.
But this one just shows, well, yes, I did get it wrong. Yes, I wasn't. You don't be a leader to be popular, but you got to be a leader you can't be a leader of one. You need support. You need a team with you.
Yeah.
So that just demonstrates, well, you're probably never going to get a nastier email than that, but you can still improve from it. And if you don't give up,
yeah,
you can actually make a difference. So the card, I see you've got a card. The cards in the front of the book. So a quote that's Alan Sikar quote that's not in the book is, leading is not easy. If you never stop learning and build a formidable team that empowers others to create a supportive and inclusive workplace, amazing things will happen.
Wow.
So that's the quote that's in that card that I sent you. Everyone that buys the book will get that quote. But really,
I'll just repeat that. Leading is not easy. If you never stop learning, build a formidable team and empower others to create a supportive and inclusive workplace, amazing things will happen. Wow.
And it will. I just proved, like, if I'd have given up because I failed in that first command, and it was pretty horrible, like that chapter talks about how horrible it was, if I'd have given up then,
did you come close to doing that?
Oh, of course. It was horrible. It was a horrible time.
Mm.
I was cool. Like, you're
ready to walk away.
It was just horrible. What had happened was I got it wrong. Even though I got it right in a lot of ways, I got it wrong. I just did too much. I was too keen as a new leader. I didn't realise the there's a jump. Like, the book's essentially about, as leaders, we evolve.
Well, it's your journey, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so... I think in any job, you're initially, if you're working with people, you influence the people around you. Then you become a supervisor, so you lead from the front.
Right.
In our job, in the cops, so you become a sergeant and an inspector.
Yeah.
People respect leading from the front. But when you become a superintendent, which is equivalent, say, of a CEO of an organisation, you can't lead from the front.
Sure.
You've got to empower others to lead. And until, like, so you see this... politically, so many other places, I'm not going to mention names, but I just fell into the trap of a lot of new leaders. I tried to do too much too quick and didn't bring people with me. I made a target on my back, and ultimately I had to go. So I had to own that. I had to own, what did I do? And I knew the story wasn't me, because ultimately the book is my story. I want to create workplaces where people are empowered, where you empower others to create its supportive and inclusive workplaces so they can thrive.
Mm.
So that email shows I didn't do it there, but I just had to learn how to do it.
Sure. Did you have people whispering to you in those bad times, those horrible times, that said, Alan, are you sure you want to do it this way?
No, not really. it was just a target time.
Not your commander or anyone at that particular time.
It was nasty. Yeah. If I think about it, it was... And it just emulates, if you get it wrong, you put a target on your back and people have a perception of you. And no matter what good you might have around you, people look at the bad perception and that's your story. And you've just got to accept your role in why you created that bad perception.
Right. I love this thing. I know it's way back in the introduction, but I love this thing where your final words were North Shore One signing off for the last time.
Yeah.
That must have been difficult for you to say.
It's,
had you been practicing?
No, not at all.
Get up in the morning and thought, in the middle of your shower, you got this other thing, what am I going to say as my last thing? But it's just they're emotional words, in my opinion.
It was, I think I described it in there, a throat croaking moment.
Correct.
and I can still remember it. I've got one of my colleagues did a video of it. It's actually, I think there's a Facebook post, if you can find it, of the whole.
Same,
yeah, and it's it doesn't come out right. It comes out.
Doesn't.
It comes out emotionally. Yeah.
Well, it is emotional. It's sort of. you know, it's sort of one of those things where you think, oh, gosh, it sort of hits you between the eyes. And you think, that's a lovely thing to say. Okay. When you... I'm going to take you right back to Guri because I've just done 3 weeks filling in at a radio station in Bourke.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I had to go through Dubbo by Guri.
Guri, yep.
When you arrived back there, could you even contemplate where you would end up? I mean, way back then, there was nothing to suggest that you were going to go into the police, was there?
Not really. My dad's brother was a police officer.
Right.
And he was
did he ever sit you on the knee and say, this is what I want
to
do?
I never met him. Oh, my dad or the uncle. No, the uncle died pretty early of cancer.
Right.
I think lung cancer.
Right.
But he was a real... Everyone loved him. Anyone that knew of him, he was a... Used to be a motorcycle cop when they had the side pillion thing.
Oh, really?
And then he went into the vice squad. And he was a real character.
Wow, what a touch.
Yeah, he was a real character. So, but anyway, so I think my dad, who was a butcher,
yep.
Always had an eye. He never said it, but I think he always had an inkling that it'd be nice to have someone else do it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Guri's a nice little town.
It's beautiful.
Have you been back?
Yeah, I've still got my uncle still there. Lives there. Yeah. Yes, he still lives. There are my kids. He's the best uncle you could ever have in the world, Michael Sickard.
Right.
He's our kids, and now their kids, our grandkids, just a day at Uncle Michael's place is pretty special.
Is he on the land or in town?
He's in town, in a big kind of, you could almost call it a rural block. It's magnificent, absolutely magnificent.
Back way through Mudgee.
Yes.
To get this in, love good. And I like the emphasis here, the title of the book highlights the word courage. Tell us a bit more about the courage.
So the courage in the traditional sense of a police officer and probably first responders is they running towards danger when everyone else is running away.
Correct.
But it's really a play on words. The courage to lead and the word courage in my book is about having the courage.
Very clever what you've done there.
Is to give your power away.
Yeah.
As a leader, and empower others to lead and trust them, because not everyone has the courage to trust the people around them to do their best.
And as Alan says in the book, this book is largely about how I went from failure several times to being a successful leader. It's a must read.
That's very kind of you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
One of the things that way back in the beginning pages of the book, but you've got to get it, dear listener, because as I said, it takes us through the Alan's journey from when he was originally refused, couldn't join.
Yeah.
He was told to go away and lose some weight.
I was too fat.
He's enjoying his cream buns, I think it was.
Yes, the gap between being an 18-year-old... Oh, no, I was allowed to join an 18. But the gap between the intake and me going for the physical was I was working for my dad in the butcher shop.
Yeah.
So, and butchers love to have morning tea and lunch and afternoon tea.
And
so
that could be a steak or something.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I have 3 meals of meat a day with my dad. But I would have cream buns and Coke 3 times a day and then go out with your mates... playing pinball machines for shouts at the local pub. So I quickly became a larger version of myself. And I didn't know, because you didn't have scales back then.
That was one of the things which which sort of inspired you to go and do something about it. I mean, you must have learned that lesson from there. You wanted to get in.
Yes.
And this sergeant said, no, bugger off. You're not up to par, Alan Sicker.
Virtually. Well, I think you're being a bit kind. He said, you're too fat. Come back in a year.
Yeah. And you were back within a shorter time than that.
I think pretty well a month or 2 months, actually. Yeah.
So in those days, is it the same now? But in those days, you could do that. You could just disappear and then come back in a very short time. You didn't have to wait until an intake was publicised and said that we're doing an intake now. This will be the class 357 of 2023 or something.
I think it's different now. I think at the moment, most police forces in Australia are experiencing where they don't have a waiting list anymore. I think 6 out of the 7 police forces in Australia don't have a waiting list anymore. So I think the scenario you're talking about is they'd probably be a little bit quicker. Right. But in my day, I mean, even say 5 years ago, 6 years ago, there was a huge waiting list. So if you missed out, like I did, it might take another 3 years before before you were considered again. But that's just Alan Sicard's version. I don't know the exact thing. But in my time, it didn't matter. Like, I just went back and they said, okay.
I understand. I've got a cousin or cousin by marriage who is in the, excuse me, in the job in Herefordshire in the UK, and he came out here and tried to get in, and he just couldn't. No one sort of opened their door for him and said, "No, we need you. Come back and apply again."
Yeah.
And he ended up saying, "Well, you know, I'm happy here," and he's found love and he doesn't.
Okay. How long ago was that?
5.
Yeah, because nowadays I just gave a talk to Tasmanian Executive Leadership Program, and there was a lady from the Human Resources of the South Australian Police.
Right.
And there, I think it's South Australia and Western Australia and maybe Queensland are seeking people from the UK.
Is that right?
Yeah, so it'd be different now, I think, yeah.
Because they feel like they need to have somebody on the beat who can come up and say, Allah, well, Allah.
that and they just need experience. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. Oh, okay. I'll have to get on to it. I know that, we mentioned you and your dad was a butcher. There's so many things I was going to ask you here. Where's my notes on the book? Well, about that sergeant, yes, we've covered that. PTSD, I know that we touched on it briefly. I just wanted to find out from your point of view, because listeners have got this concept that during the police, that the police are always there in your face and they're not out solving crime because they've pulled them over for going a few k's over the limit or whatever. But police are always the first on the scene, aren't they?
That's their title.
First responders,
yeah.
Police are first on the scene, followed by one AMBOs and FOREs at probably at about the same time.
Yes.
Now, each of those services, as well as me being the ex-army officer, that you go through various procedures when you sort of click into gear and you know that you've got to go ahead and handle a particular job, but later you start thinking about things. Now, when you were a commander at Chatswood and at other commands, did you have any of your men or ladies coming up to you and saying, I'm not feeling too good? I mean, how was it handled? Was it handled any differently under your command than under previous commanders?
Well, no, I probably don't want to go there. I'll just give my own journey. As a commander, like I was a commander for 15 years and a police officer for 40 years. So you learn over time, probably self-learn, the signs. So
is it talked about in the... Well, I know you joined in 1980.
Yeah.
But when you were at the academy, was it raised then about...
Not in 1980.
No.
Yeah, I think it is now. I'm pretty sure it is now in the year 2023.
Right.
But if I just approach it this way, so... What I found, like the book's about evolving leadership and about getting better at supporting your people, creating a supportive and inclusive workplace where people can thrive. So that means about you're targeting in it their well-being. So over my journey as a commander, I learnt to stop talking about performance and issues like that. So what I've learnt probably in the last 5 years of my being a police commander and my career, and this is what it's an evolving leadership story. You don't need to talk about performance if you're looking after your people. So,
because they are out there doing the job because they want to do it.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So what?
Not to necessarily please you.
No.
We've got to do this for the boss because
it's supporting each other.
You'll give me an all-day sucker at the end of the day.
So yeah. No. They don't do it for me. They do it for each other, and they do it for their community. So, what we would have a morning briefing Monday to Friday,
right.
And what I learned over time.
Is this a formal parade?
Kind of. No, they're not standing up. They're not standing up. They're just sitting around like a training room. Yeah. It could be 40 to 50 people sometimes in the room in chairs. And the commander always had to get up and talk. And so I made it my business not to talk about performance. I'd highlight good work that people had done, and I'd highlight the horrible jobs that some of our mates had gone to. And I'd make sure that without embarrassing the person that had been to the horrible job, that the rest of the team did whatever they could to support that person that had been to that job. And
we're talking about things like fatal car accidents,
horrible suicides, horrible assaults, horrible mental health jobs, where people have our police have done an amazing job, and we'd highlight. That I would highlight that on the parade. You're like Jeff went to this job, did an outstanding job, it was really confronting. Do whatever you can to support him. And as a team, please don't make if he's lining up to go to the next one, make sure he doesn't have to go.
He's on number one.
Make sure it's someone else's turn. Right. And that's all I talk about. So that's and I found by doing that, if you support each other, the well-being and the support of the command, like there's a whole chapter in that book about support, it started to improve. So one of the things that we did in that book, as my kind of leadership style got
evolved
after doing the collar bomb, the Mossman collar bomb and the Link Cafe, I thought, well, what can I do with those experiences? I can teach our next crop of leaders how to prepare and respond to the next big job, because it's going to happen. So I created this two-day high-risk workshop where I had...
In the station?
No, it was at... we did it at HMAS Penguin. I took all of our sergeants and our inspectors and some other inspectors from other stations wanted to come as well. So we probably had over 50 people at that supervisor inspector level at this two-day workshop. I had... the commanders of the Link Cafe that actually were there when they said go in, and hearing them tell their story about the briefing they got after it was all resolved and the pain on their faces, you could have heard a pin drop in that resilience 2 days. And then I had the command, because I knew him, the commander of the two Melbourne Bourke Street jobs, you know, where
oh really?
Yeah, so I knew him. He got up and talked to them. And there was another couple as well. But then one of the best guest speakers of those 2 days was a bloke called Alan Sparks. He lives on the Northern Beaches. I think he lives on a boat somewhere in Pittwater. But he's a lived experience PTSD guy. He's lived it. And he's probably one of the nation's best speakers on well-being. So he spoke to our people. And he had this chart. He had this little table that had four columns. And essentially, if you're on column 3 or 4, your exhibit, and it gives... behaviours that you're exhibiting, you need help. You need to start thinking about getting help. And any of us that are cops or first responders, we can all relate to the items in 3 and 4. So what I did out of that, once Alan Sparks had given that workshop and I could see the value of this chart, I had the little chart made up into notebook cards. You know, I had them all laminated by our volunteers in policing that we had at Chatswood. And so there was, say, 300 notebook cards that we'll put into the...
put inside your little...
in your notebook, And then I had the biggest one, A3 ones laminated and put behind every toilet door in the police station, and then put in the on the notice boards of the meal rooms and everything. And what that did, it didn't mean Alan Sickard had to look out for the well-being of everyone. It meant that everyone was looking up...
supporting
each other. And it was simple, you're exhibiting... column 3 here, the thing was, are you okay? And out of that, when we did that, probably 3 of our people went and sought some mental health support that wouldn't have, because one of their peers had said, are you okay?
In a way, I'm sort of turning that around and being a little bit wistful, thinking, well, you've saved 3 lives, haven't you?
I don't think you could say I did, but you can say there's so many themes in this book, The Courage to Lead, but the support chapter talks about this, and I've lived it. If we have support, we can, if we have true support, we can just about weather any storm, no matter how bad that storm is. But if we don't have support, we will crumple and probably wither away.
Right.
So the book, the whole chapter about support is about, it's our job in a well-being culture, in a culture where, you know, the boss, it has to be led at a boss level, and then the formidable team around the boss. If you create a culture where people are empowered to create a workplace where that's inclusive and inclusive and supportive, the workplace will thrive. You just have to work at that. And that those examples, it just becomes everyone's business to look after it. Yeah.
Did it ever get to the stage, and you talk about this being in the last 5 years of your command, and when we're talking about North Shore?
Yes.
Where were you before that? Oh, Harbourside.
North Shore, Harbourside, so that's North Shore is Chatswood. North Shore ended up with a combination of Chatswood and North Sydney. Before I got that gig, that was in 2017.
Right.
Before I got that gig, I was the commander at Harbourside, which is North Sydney.
Based in North Sydney.
And before that, I was at Rose Bay, and I'll just leave the other one.
But you did have a time in Highway.
That's funny. Not everyone knows this. Before I had my lovely wife Kerry, and we've been in together since 1984 now.
He was walking across the street in Golden.
She definitely caught my eye. She still catches my eye this morning. I was married previously, and I got divorced after 18 months, and I was fly blown. I had no money. I was divorced. I was in the stages of divorce, so I had to get to Goulburn to live with my mum and dad.
We're talking about the Goulburn police station.
Not
the academy.
So I got a job in Goulburn police station in Highway.
Right.
That was the only place that I could get a transfer out. Yes, and there's a funny story in that.
Yeah.
In the first day of the highway course, they used to run the highway patrol course in the old kind of warehouses under the Sydney Harbour Bridge on the northern approaches.
Take one of my army mates, if you're listening, you know, it was called STP or something in those days.
Yeah.
Special Traffic Patrol.
Whatever. And
it was underneath the bridge.
Yeah, and it was the most decrepit.
Now occupied by rescue or no?
No, I don't think so. Okay. I think there's some car dealers there now. So the first day, we got this beautiful kind of introduction. Welcome to the highway course. And then this other sergeant came in and said, "Right, you bastards!" Essentially, he said, "We know some of you are just trying to get here. You're only here to get a transfer. We know who you are, and we're going to get rid of you." I thought, how did he know? But he never found me, so it was good. But I did Hawaii for 3 years in Goulburn, and that was...
How far would you travel? Would you go as far as Queanbeyan?
Yeah, you'd go 200 kilometres either way. Sometimes, but Cooma had its own highway patrol.
Right.
Queanbeyan had its own highway patrol.
Yes.
But you'd travel up to 200 kilometres... Every day. But at that stage, Goulburn was the only place with a dual highway, so it was pretty fantastic. Place to be as a young, like, I'm not a petrol head or a motor sports person, but to be taught how to drive a manual V8 Commodore 5-litre car at its maximum was a privilege, and get paid to do it.
And the training was up here at St. Albans.
Yes.
On the skid pad.
Yeah, and then all over.
Run by Hearts.
And then because I was in Highway Patrol in Goulburn, it gave me the opportunity to be a part-time police rescue squad, a part-time special weapons operator as well. So I learnt these amazing skills that I never would have learnt.
You're taking the words out of my mouth. Yeah. You moved to rescue. Was that something which came naturally to you, or you're a guy, I've formed this opinion about you, Alan Sicko, ever since I've known you, that you're going to put your hand up and give a go at anything, aren't you? Yeah.
Pretty well, yeah. I mean, that's the only way, like, as someone I interviewed recently on my podcast series, The Courage to Lead, he said the day that we stop being curious and learning something, we're actually heading towards the grave. So I've always tried to learn something new.
Well, from your time saying, okay, I'm going to go into highway, and you did the... Well, probably even before that, when you were determined to get into the job, and a month later there you are back with the same...
Yes.
The same sergeant saying, what are you doing back here, cigar? Sort of and you got in.
Yes.
So you put your hand up for that, you put your hand up for the highway. Tell us about the police rescue. And if you watch that show on TV that's going around now, is that true to life?
I haven't seen the new one. I saw the old TV show, which was pretty good, Police Rescue with Gary Sweet. That was good. I'm showing my age now. Yeah. I was part-time rescue, so I was full-time highway patrol.
Right.
And so if a job came in when I was on duty, because highway patrol was so mobile, I could either go straight to the job or go back to the police station and get in the big F-350 police rescue truck and off we'd go. Or then the other time we'd be on call at night or whatever when we're off. So it was pretty, it's probably the most amazing course I've ever done, really. What you learnt, like I'm pretty well, even though I'm come from Orange, a country town, I'm pretty well a city, I am a city boy. Right. So I didn't have many skills, I suppose you'd say. Right. So there's this still funny story in the rescue squad chapter about learning how to use a chainsaw. and that must have been, so that's 1984, 85. So that's before work health and safety was really a thing. So they taught me how to use...
Alan still has got 10 fingers.
Yes. I'm still pretty atrocious. I got three chainsaws now at home and I'm still pretty hopeless.
Do they
scare you? I'm respectful of them. but the way they taught me, you actually had to learn to strip a chainsaw, I think, strip it and put it back together in a minute.
Well, blindfolded?
No, you meant blindfolded.
This is like an army thing.
It made you pretty good with it after a while, but initially I had no clue on how to do it. But then they taught me to use the chainsaw. We went to, I'm pretty sure it was Marrickville. They took our rescue training class to a street in Marrickville where they needed to, they had permission from the council to trim their paperbark trees away from the power lines.
Yes.
So my first use of a chainsaw was climbing up a paperbark with the chainsaw above my head, chopping these branches in the, I think it was raining because it was anyone that used a chainsaw when you put the goggles on and everything, they fog up pretty quick. And in 1984, a chainsaw was made of metal, not plastic, so it was heavy. And then I let it drop after a while because I couldn't keep it up. And then I let it drop onto my leg, but the chain was still gone. And it ripped through. I had the police rescue overalls, which were pretty thick, but it still cut through my overalls and grazed my leg.
Did it lacerate the skin? Yeah.
It made it red, but it didn't cut it, thank God. But that was enough for the instructor. Sick on, get down! and then at the end of chainsawing for the day, because they hadn't contemplated that would happen, I think.
Right.
Yeah.
But some of those rescue jobs that you went to, they were pretty horrific too. Mm.
I'm
picturing you being in the Wombeyan Caves or something like that.
That was Bungonia Caves. That's in there, I think. That story. There's one cave, and I forget what it's called. I think it's Drum Cave. But the way into that is what they call the rib breaker squeeze or something. Right. So if you're too big and you breathe out at the wrong time in that section, you will actually crack your ribs.
Right?
So, but down the bottom of Drum Cave is these subterranean streams that people dive in. So these divers had gone down and they got exhausted and they couldn't get back out. So my job that night essentially was to lie in the rib breaker section because I was small enough for a couple of hours probably ferrying all the gear through there.
Wow. So the rescue of those boys overseas in that cave in was something that you particularly really understood, wasn't it?
Ours wasn't as heroic as that one, but yeah, it's I do understand.
In those guys' eyes, you would have been, though, mate, because you saved their lives again.
Yeah, I actually remember them. They weren't that happy with us because they were embarrassed that they were pretty cranky. I remember that. I remember that emotion. They were cranky that we come and got them, but they were beyond exhausted. Yeah.
Did you ever get claustrophobic?
No, you would think you would learn it if that was going to happen. No, well, some of the training we did in rescue would really try you out with that. They put you under. It's part of the. I think the. The old ambulance headquarters in around... It's around here somewhere, I think. It used to be. And they used to put you underneath the basement of their buildings. They'd fill it full of smoke. They'd put you... That's where you learn how to use your breathing apparatus stuff.
Yeah.
And they'd make your goggles black and you'd have to just crawl your way. Right. Yeah. So if that didn't make me claustrophobic, no, I'm all right.
I'm not going to keep you for all day, although I could chat to you forever. Let's zoom ahead to the Mossman Colobon.
Mm-hmm.
What were you doing that day? How did you get? I know you've told this story before on air, but we may have new listeners.
So it was, I think it was 11th of October 2011. It was about, I might have the wrong date in October, August, but. It was August 2011. It was about 2:30 in the afternoon. I wasn't talking to the mic.
It was just a normal day for you at North Sydney.
And this was when
you're at Harbour Side.
North Sydney, yes. So, and I was just doing the mundaneness of command stuff, signing off some correspondence, when the police radio had it put over the air that a young lady had a device attached to her neck, which was purported to be a bomb. That bomb had a note attached to it, and I remember the highway patrol officer read out the note in full to everyone listening, and it was the most deadening silence you've ever heard on the police radio when he was reading it out, and then and everyone, that's a real job.
Would he have been aware of it?
Oh, yeah. He's a good guy. I remember who that was. Yes, yeah. And then, so I knew from that straight away, that's a real job. I got on the air and said, Harbourside 1, I'm on my way to that job. I'll be there in 20, 30 minutes. Just letting you know I'm on my way. And then I got on the phone and let a bloke called, he was a superintendent at that time, Tony Cook. He was the operations manager for Central Metropolitan Region.
Right.
He's now the region commander of that region.
Right.
And I briefed him what the job was, and then I was on the way. Rang him, and then it's the beauty of what this book's kind of all about. It's not about you, it's about a team effort creating in many minds, having better, more power.
I think I said this last time, Alan, but I really believe that a lot of this for you could have been a little bit cathartic, because the way that you've written the book in the first person, it's just sort of fabulous. And I'm thinking, is this Alan sort of feeling that he can sort of unload and relive these things? Well, not relive them so much, but bring out some of the stuff that you'd forgotten had occurred back then.
I don't think I'll ever forget that job. I think the message of the book is build a formidable team around you.
Yeah.
And it's, as a leader, it's not about you.
Yeah.
Create the environment for people to excel.
Yeah.
So that's ultimately Tony Cook that day said to me, think about Al, thanks for the briefing. Think about ringing the negotiators to help out with the young woman who was Madeleine Pulver.
Had you done any negotiation?
No, I hadn't done that. No.
Yeah.
There's only so many opportunities you can pursue in the cops. But so I rang the negotiators. Initially, they said, that's not our job. After a bit of persuasion, discussion, they said, okay, we'll come. Because I said, I know it's not your job to help, but she's going to need your help.
Sure.
So then we went to the job. I got there. I was briefed by the sergeant and the inspector, there was two inspectors, all of them were exceptional, what they'd already set up.
Yep.
And then I was briefed by the bomb squad sergeant, and he pulled me aside. He said, "Mr. Sickard, I'm going to tell you three things. Where your policewoman is," because we had the sergeant and the inspector, and then me had made the decision to leave a senior constable of police with the victim, Madeline Pulver, to provide her with support so she wasn't on her own, and plus to keep the device stationary.
To all intents and purposes, that in inverted commas, bomb was alive.
Yes, yeah. Well, a bomb's a bomb until it's not.
Yeah.
Totally. And Karen, that lady was Senior Constable Karen Loudon, who ultimately went on to win so many international bravery awards for what she did that day.
Right.
But she also agreed to stay there. But right. So this is the pretext into this briefing by this bomb squad sergeant. I said, "Mr. Sickard, where Senior Constable Loudon is, she will die if it goes off. The number two thing I need to tell you, Mr. Sickard, is the success rate of removing a collar bomb worldwide is 0%.
Whoa.
And then the third thing was, because of the note that was read out over the radio, made this reference to an American collar bomb that had only happened in the last couple of years, and it was on a 2-hour timer.
Okay.
So that's the briefing you get.
Yeah.
So then you just, you created, I did so what I could so to...
There's no fear in you at that stage, you're putting your shoulders back, chest out, and thinking...
Well, you think, I think I put it in the book, that's the worst briefing I've ever heard in my head.
Yeah.
But I can't communicate that to everyone. So my job is just, and this is what I've learned from the failures that I talk about in the book.
Yeah.
I exposed myself to as many command situations that I could for about the previous 4 years before this job.
Right.
And so I knew my job was to create an environment where the experts could do their best. So the bomb squad inspector in particular, and I talk about this in the book, someone was ringing him that was giving him an earful, because he was his hand was fully extended. Whoa. and I could hear what was going on. But then at the same time,
who would that have been?
I'm not going to say. Okay. But it was obvious he was getting a hard time from someone. Yeah. And then repeatedly. And then my job's to work with him.
Yeah.
We've got to work together. So him and I, we've become great mates. He sent me a beautiful message the next day.
That'd
about
be.
Probably the best bomb job he'd ever been to. Kind of, I hope we do more jobs together. I'm sure you hope we don't. But,
yeah.
But my job was to, and when you sit back and watch people like that, like he was on the phone when he wasn't getting yelled at, to bomb squad experts in England, in Russia, all over the world were trying to help him.
Really?
Yeah. So that's what I say at a command level, the job is not about us. It's about creating the environment for the best to do their best. And they do. They absolutely step up, and I won't spoil the rest of that chapter.
Right.
It's ultimately, if you create the environment where people can thrive, they will do their best. I really think nowadays in particular, so many of us got bogged down in we have to have the perfect solution. But if we as a leader create an environment that has good people, and we let those good people do what they're best at, they'll work it out. They'll work it out.
Was he the bomb squad sergeant? Was he ex-military?
The inspector?
The sergeant, the bomb squad guy.
The first? I don't know.
It was just a little fellow who used to be in the military police, and he ended up in bomb squad in Katoomba or something. I can't remember.
I do know because I've met him since. One of the guys in the bomb squad gear that was helping with Madeline Pulver.
Yeah.
He's now an assistant sheriff for the sheriffs of New South Wales.
Is that right?
Assistant commissioner right. level.
Okay.
Sheriff. Yeah. So wow. he's kicked on.
Wow. Okay. Madeline Pulver, do you still keep in touch?
No. We last time we met was when Mr. Scipione was commissioner, and he did an award ceremony around some of those big jobs. I'm pretty sure her and Karen Loudon would still be in contact.
Okay.
Right? Yeah.
Okay. And the accused, or the crim in that particular case?
I think he's out by now.
Yeah.
I think he got 7 or 9 years, okay. and I think he got parole.
Okay.
Because I read it was a news article a couple of years ago.
I saw that. Okay. Now, zooming on, Lyd Cafe. I know you told this story before. Do you get sick of telling it?
No. It's funny. All the things that we set up for the collar bomb, helped prepare me for the Lyd Cafe just by chance.
So when the Lyd Cafe happened, if I remember correctly,
December 2014. Yeah, I was.
You were commander of Sydney.
I wasn't. I was the, what would you call, relieving commander, I suppose. The commander of Sydney City Command had just been given a 3 months opportunity to relieve as an assistant commissioner up in the northern region of New South Wales.
Right.
So Mr. Fuller, at that time was the assistant commissioner of Central Metropolitan Region, asked me to do the city for 3 months.
Okay. And you were based down at the Rocks or up
in... Nah, based in Day Street.
Day Street.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So I was on the Sydney Harbour Bridge when...
Driving,
on my way to a rescue...
You've heard the story before, dear listener. He's Alan Sickard doing a U-turn.
Essentially.
You got to the other end, didn't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, there you go. There's a... I forget
you
what
were heading north at the time.
I was heading north. I heard the job come over. I answered it. It's pretty well the same scenario as the collar bomb. Yeah. Sydney City 1. I've heard that job. I'm on my way to do that job. But this is what I learnt from the collar bomb. Can I ask that you do these following two things? Because I've learnt in a leadership position, and if you can prepare your people to think about what they want in advance before getting there, the pitch is better. Yeah. So I asked on the radio after I turned around, or maybe as I was turning around.
You could have been enhanced a little bit by having a U-turn.
I knew how to do it, so I didn't have to do anything so radical.
Yeah.
But I asked on the radio. I said, "Can you get the traffic commander for the metropolitan region to go to the Lyd Cafe, and I want him to set up a traffic plan, a perimeter that locks down the area so it's secure. But I want the same plan" to let the rest of the city of Sydney function, because we can't, I didn't say this over the air, but we can't afford the city to be shut down.
Completely.
Yeah. So, and he's retired now, a bloke called Paul Founds, Inspector Paul Founds, and his mate, Senior Sergeant Mark Chapman, they set up in Hyde Park. I've got pictures of how wonderful what they did was, and if you look at pictures of how the inner perimeter of the Lyd Cafe was in those first 2 hours, it was pristine. Mm. So they did a great job.
Right.
Did an absolutely great job.
Right. Okay. So did you get the call? I'm going to take that job.
I got to take that job.
So you rang your boss straight away?
Yeah, it was Mick Fuller at the time. He was Assistant Commissioner Mick Fuller. I told him that I'd heard on the air one of our other colleagues had said he'd been on the air and said I'd rung the Lyd Cafe. That's where we get our coffees from. They're not answering it. I think it's real. It was obvious it was real. So then I told Mr. Fuller I'm on my way, and he said, make sure that negotiators or someone was on the way, which I'd already asked for. But what the amazing thing, again, an example of communication and a team effort. So the minute I rang Mr. Fuller and he's just kept the briefing coming, like he's on level 7 of the Sydney Police Centre in Goulburn Street, in his office. So he hung up from me and then went to level 4 of the Sydney Police Centre in Goulburn Street to the Police Operations Centre and set up his incident command team with 7 superintendents from that phone call.
Wow.
So,
and that's something which has been... Is rehearsed all the time?
No, it's not rehearsed. No, that's quite unusual. That's really? He did that within 5 minutes. So 5 to 10 minutes. So to get 7 superintendents there pretty quick.
Well done.
It just shows you the value of thinking in advance, of communications, and we're in this together.
Yeah. Okay. So he's completely confident that he's got the right man on the job. He's got Alan Sicko.
This is where it gets interesting. So I think he had confidence in how I went. He gave me that feedback after. But
because it was well known that you were the guy who looked at the Colobon thing.
Yeah, but there's
and therefore he must know how to handle a siege at the Lincoln Cafe.
You're very kind. The story in the cops in any police organisation is that there's a cadre of leaders trained to respond to a terrorism incident.
Right.
So at the Colobon stage, they thought it was Australia's first terror incident. Yeah. So they turned up with, it's called Strike Force Pioneer.
Yeah.
They turned up at the Colobon ready to take over from me if the bomb was ever declared real, but it never was. So I was always in charge.
Right.
The same thing happened at the Link Cafe. Like, that's a terrorist incident. We know it's a terrorist incident. So Alan Sicard, who's not terrorist trained commander, is not going to stay in charge.
Oh, okay.
And then Mick Fuller, also at the time, wasn't a terrorist trained police commander, so he was relieved. We were both relieved after about 2 hours by Strike Force Pioneer, because they were trained to do. I'm retired now, but I was made a terrorism trained commander after that, and things changed. But that's how it worked. So they actually, any organisation, and I'm not bitter about it. Any organisation puts in their best trained people to do it, and I wasn't trained to do it. Right. So.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So was that the reason why you were there for only 2 hours?
Yes. Yeah, I was relieved. As soon as we'd done, and I won't talk about it because the book covers it, but we did so much in that first 2 hours that our team did an amazing level of work.
Was that a smooth handover?
Yes, yeah. When I turned around, I saw him, the superintendent, and I'm like, oh, I know what's going on here, because I just knew.
Did he need to come up to you and say, I'm relieving you?
Yes, No, we were in the thick of a briefing, and then I turned around and saw him, and then he pretty well said what you said. But he said, you're welcome to stay for as long as you want. So I just stayed. I stayed and learnt.
So what, yeah.
I stayed till about 10 o'clock at night.
Wow. Wow. Okay. Are you still in touch with anyone from there or no?
Yes. To write some of the stuff I wrote in the book, I was in contact with one of the main commanders that was there when it all happened, all went down. He's like I talk about in my book, one of my greatest passions is to empower others to lead and create other leaders. So I used to do, for the last 20 years, at least the last 15 years, a leadership development workshop every year, and one of my go-to guest speakers was the guy that actually sent them in to the Link Cafe. But before that, he was, and I won't give away some of the other stuff because people will know, but he's done things that other Australian commanders have never, ever done. So when I get him up in front of the leadership workshops, people are just in awe. I didn't know you could do this as a police officer. Like, he's amazing. So him and I still talk. It's funny, he's actually one of the lead-in about the author talks about me and my beekeeping.
Yeah.
He's a beekeeper as well.
Oh, is he?
Yeah, so he's taken it. It's quite funny how we take up these different things.
We shut talking about your bees. okay, now we're running out of time, but fascinating man. we'll skim over your boxing prowess. last time you were here, we were talking about homelessness.
Yes, yeah.
And you were appointed, or you accepted the mantle of being the police representative for homelessness.
Yes.
What was the official title?
Just the sponsor. I think you call it the sponsor. We're all superintendents had a sponsorship, and I was the sponsor for homelessness.
And I love the way that you described it last time, that you're all sitting in a room with all these other superintendents and said, we want to give you a job.
No, how it happened was the commander in charge of all of us said, we need a volunteer for to be the sponsor of homelessness. And right. and my well, I think the way I would describe it is you could have heard crickets drop because no one wanted to be the sponsor.
And they blew it their eyes.
Yeah, yeah. And I said, I'll do it because at that stage, I was the commander of North Sydney, Harbourside. And we just, in the last couple of months before that meeting, had two people die in the caves at Waverton
right.
Of homelessness, and I thought, in one of the wealthiest areas of Australia.
And that was in your bailiwick.
Yeah, and I thought, well, how does this happen? So I just wanted to learn what can we do about it.
Right.
Yeah.
Zoom ahead to the boots.
Yeah. So let's get to the boots part of it. So I made it my business to just... the same thing, create an environment with like-minded people where we could collaborate together and work together to house people, house homelessness people.
Right.
So part of that mission is to raise awareness about how easy it is to become homeless. So part of every year there's a homelessness week in Australia. And so to raise awareness of homelessness, I suggested that any police station in New South Wales that wanted to participate could donate their second-hand police boots to Mission Australia.
And this suggestion went out to Broken Hill and
everywhere.
Burke, where I've just been, and yeah. everyone.
Not everyone did it, but there's a lot did it. Yes. Right. Yeah. And then those boots were gathered up and ultimately given to different people. Yeah.
How were they distributed? Who decided what?
Mission Australia take it out. Like that first year it happened, a good friend of mine who's now a counsellor at Goulburn, where I used to be, he's one of the local counsellors of a fellow called Daniel Strickland, who used to be with Mission Australia.
Right.
He took a box load of, a ute load of boots from me from Harbourside and then drove them straight to Belmore Park, I think in the city. And put, and I'm pretty sure there's a picture in the book of it, of a couple of homeless guys putting on their boots because they, when you're homeless, you can't afford.
Sure.
And they were so proud of it. It was beautiful. Yeah. Yeah. It was just good quality boots.
Had each of those boots been polished?
No.
Here's the old army and me coming out. Okay. That's interesting. I'll have to get you to talk with a lady who comes in here from Cerebral Palsy Alliance in St. Ives. Sam Bing comes in here and she's just got a degree or just got a master's degree in homelessness.
I think she'd
really like to. So you're happy to come back?
Yeah, of course. Yeah,
come back.
Yeah.
Madeline Poole, we've talked about. Police Rescue, we've talked about. The Kokoda track, you went on that with your
son? My son and I did that. That was
whose suggestion, yours?
I asked him. I just knew that I would like to do it because the Police Legacy did an annual event just before Anzac Day in Papua New Guinea,
yeah.
and the trek would always finish the day before the Anzac Day dawn service at Paulina Cemetery in Port Moresby.
Yeah.
So I asked my son, "Do you want to do it?" And he loves the challenge. So yeah,
does he?
Is he
in the job?
No, he's he always did fancy a career in the cops, but he's a really good electrician, and now he's a project manager for a building company on the Northern Beaches.
Oh, okay. Interesting. Okay, so did you do lots of training for that?
We went to the sand hills of Kurnell every weekend. Kirk and I. Yeah, he killed me. You know, he's a weapon. He's 6'6", and just could do
three. Yeah,
it's just the healthy next generation just grow. I think
he'd be ideal on the job.
Yeah, he would be. Yeah, yeah. He's he'd have to give up too much now.
With his own business.
Yeah. It's not his business. He's a manager for this other company.
Yeah. Mate, thanks for coming in. Really, really, really appreciate it. The courage to lead, resilience and compassion in police command, but it doesn't only apply in police, but that's where your experience lies in the police. The same thing happens in but the same thing applies to anything in the military as well.
Or any business.
Any organisation.
Yeah.
And I for some reason, when I was reading through it, I didn't expect that there would be pictures at the end. Yeah. This is fabulous. And I can see that you've done that deliberately because it just piques your interest to keep going through there, and suddenly everything is coming out there. Well done. I see Simon Jones is in there.
Yes, he's one of the best people I ever worked with. We were a good team together.
I like Simon. The Courage to Lead, any good bookshops or...
Yeah, you can. If you go to my website, alansickard.com, it's on the opening page.
A-double-L-A-N.
Sickard.
S-I-C-A-R-D.
.com. So it's the opening...
.au or just...
No, just .com. And it's there, the links to a number of bookstores. It's in Berkelow's at Hornsby. It's at Harry Hartog's in Macquarie Centre. It's at Abbey's Books in the city.
Right.
It's making its way around. It's in the Constant Reader at Crow's Nest, and I'm just about to do a library thing at North Sydney for that, and in the Stanton Library. And it's in the Three Sparrows in Mossman.
Okay.
And there's one more. Oh, in... Burns Bay Bookery in Lane Cove, yes. But it's I think it's soon to be in, I think it's called Fuller's Bookshop in Hobart.
Nothing to do with... Okay, in a world full of leaders who put their egos first and crave power in the spotlight, this is a story about a leader who did exactly the opposite in the autocratic arena of policing. I love that. This is a story about Alan Sickard, a leader who empowered others to lead, and goes on that you're... I love the significance of that you joined in 1980, you left in 2020.
Yeah.
Obviously, you're there for 40 years, and I'm sure you didn't think about that, but it's a nice little segue.
It was nice and neat, yeah.
So, thanks for coming in. I'm going to... I'll play this particular track for you, and you can go out with it, but thanks for coming in.
Thanks very much. Thanks for your listeners for listening, and thanks for the opportunity.
This is for you. Congratulations. Good book.